evolutionary force. We know that the planetary and the genetic are connected. The big trends on Earth have, since the beginning of life, shuffled the genes and shaped the evolution of life on Earth. But making real connections between the two, that's tricky. I mean, it's a long distance from the planetary to the genetic.
Don't forget to tell him we're orbiting in our spaceship, John.
Oh, I was just getting to the spaceship. Folks, meet Adam Burke. He's our program's producer, reporter. He's a mechanic, right? Think of him as the person who keeps our scientific metaphors in tip-top shape. Now, he's currently repairing a few mechanical things before we get underway in our spaceship. How's it going, Adam?
Fine. Almost done.
As I was saying, it's a long way between the planetary and the genetic. But scientists are making some connections.
Okay, all fixed up and ready to go.
Yeah, right. We got a program to do here. Okay, so imagine you're above planet Earth as we are right now in our spaceship. Man, that is one nice place to look at, Earth.
Not a bad view at all.
Not a bad view at all. It's Earth, for heaven's sakes. And if you stayed up here a long time, you'd start to see things. That's right. You'd see changes in response to a warming world. The glaciers at the poles are changing, as many have heard. But when we talked to Camille Parmesan, she's a biologist at the University of Texas, she told us that some of the biological changes underway right now would also be visible over time.
From space, what you'd be seeing is sort of an expansion of the tropics, tropical species moving into temperate zone species moving into boreal zones, the boreal forest moving into the tundra, and then the polar regions getting much smaller.
We tend to think that it's just a few exotic and polar species that have already started reacting to climate change. After all, the Earth has only warmed 0.7 degrees centigrade on average over the past century.
That would be 1.2 degrees Fahrenheit, John.
Thank you, Adam. A few years ago, Camille Parmesan and a colleague looked into just how many species had responded in some way to climate change. They compiled data on more than 1,700 species worldwide. Everything from plants to birds to butterflies to intertidal invertebrates to plankton. Across all of these groups, half of the species are showing some kind of a response.
Either they're breeding earlier, or they're shifting their ranges northward, or they're accelerating their generation time. So it's, you know, it's a little different depending on who you're looking at. But that's absolutely astounding that 50% of species are doing something different from what they were doing 30 or 40 or 100 years ago.
Parmesan says that about 40% of the species she's looked at have shifted their ranges away from the equator and toward the poles.
And this is a combination of shifting their breeding grounds, if they're a migratory species, or actually shifting where they live. So if they're a very sedentary species that doesn't move very much, they're actually shifting the whole region in which they live.
So this is one strategy for dealing with climate change. Species are moving to follow their climate. Not necessarily a new strategy, though.
During the glacial and interglacial cycles, the Pleistocene glaciations, species would move around by 1,000, 2,000 miles, trying to track their climate.
Of course, back then, creatures didn't have an obstacle course of freeways, farm fields, and cities to deal with when they moved. So this time around, some are managing and some aren't. But it definitely seems to be a popular coping strategy. Are there any others, Adam?
Well, there's timing. Parmesan told us that species are also shifting when they do things, too. So take spring, for example.
I love spring.
So we're seeing birds breeding earlier, frogs breeding earlier, trees leafing out earlier, flowers blooming earlier.
And you know, there's a growing body of science that says at least some of these shifts are genetic.
Really?
Yep. Ooh, speaking of timing. Pardon me.
What are you doing?
Seatbelt.
Whoa!
Okay, hold on.
Hold on. Hey, does that mean we're going in?
Oh yeah, we're going in. And then out into the living room of two scientists in Eugene, Oregon.
Whoa. Warn me about that next time, will you?
Yeah, like I'm going to warn you. It's way more fun not to warn you. Now listen. These scientists study an insect called the pitcher plant mosquito. Scientific name, Wyomaya smithii, though William Bradshaw refers to it affectionately as Wyomaya.
Wyomaya is a mosquito that breeds only in the stomach of a carnivorous plant.
That plant grows in bogs all the way from the Gulf of Mexico to northern Canada.
Whoa.
Yeah, and its leaves are shaped like a small water pitcher.
No.
Really?
This is a pitcher plant that collects rainwater throughout the year.
And that's Christina Holtzopfel. She and her husband William Bradshaw are evolutionary biologists, and they've been studying the pitcher plant mosquito for over 35 years. So they're fairly well acquainted with the host plant and the mosquito larva, which is a
teeny tiny little
wrigglers, they're called. Now, these wrigglers live in the watery bowl of the plant, feeding on a buffet of mucky rainwater and disintegrating insects that are trapped there.
Delicious.
They have little orange mouth brushes, and those little brushes are filtering the food that they eat.
So that's what these little wrigglers do. All summer long, eggs hatch in the plants, and juveniles wriggle around, eating and growing, and eventually becoming adults. Takes between 3 to 4 weeks on average. But around late summer, early fall, these larvae come to a fork in the road.
That's right. They have to go back to mosquito school. Isn't that the deal?
No, John. Adult pitcher plant mosquitoes can't make it through the winter. So after a certain point in the year, it's no longer safe to turn into an adult. Around late summer, early fall, the larvae shift into a sort of holding pattern called dormancy, so they won't develop into adults until spring.
Wow, so they turn into like Peter Pan mosquitoes all winter long, just stuck in childhood, eating and wriggling around in the belly of the plant?
Yeah, even under the snow.
Whoa, but wait a minute. Didn't you say that the larvae start to go into dormancy around August or September?
That's right.
Well, how do they know winter is coming? I mean, fall hasn't even arrived yet.
Ah, that's where the plot thickens, John. They use the length of day.
When days are getting short, winter is coming. When days are getting long, spring is coming. And Wyomaya has a highly accurate ability to measure the length of day. They can measure the length of day to within 5 minutes. And they use day length then to predict into the future when winter is coming and to time the onset of their dormancy at the optimal time.
These Wyomayas can measure the length of day to within 5 minutes?
Yep. Birds use similar cues to determine when to migrate.
Really?
Yeah, they're not conscious decisions. They're genetic cues, hardwired into the animal.
So little clocks hardwired into mosquitoes and birds, what does any of this have to do with climate change?
Well, when Bradshaw and Holtzopfel started their research in the early 1970s, they didn't know it had anything to do with climate change. They were just studying the timing of when pitcher plant mosquitoes were entering dormancy. But in spring of 2002, they realized their mosquito work might have something to say about climate change and evolution. So they dug out a data set comparing timing of dormancy over a 24-year period. And then, a bit shocked by what they saw, they checked a 5-year comparison.
What we expected to see in the analysis of the 5-year data set was nothing. What we actually saw was that the mosquitoes were evolving in a tiny, short time frame, 5 years. That was just stunning to us.
We talk about evolutionary time, and we think evolutionary time takes decades or centuries or millennia to occur. And we don't think of evolutionary time being on the order of a few years. And when we saw the shift over a 5-year period, that said to us, this is evolution occurring at breakneck speed due to climate warming.
So wait a minute. Evolution at breakneck speed, what does that mean?
That means that populations of pitcher plant mosquitoes were evolving to shift the timing of their dormancy to later in the year. Timing of dormancy in the pitcher plant mosquito is genetic, remember?
Okay, right.
Okay, good. So here's how it works. Each population of mosquitoes has evolved to go into dormancy at a particular time of the year.
Okay.
But within any one population, there will be a range of responses.
Well, of course.
Some individual larvae will go into dormancy earlier, some go later.
Okay, I think I'm still with you.
The thing is, there are evolutionary consequences to the timing of all this.
Timing is essential.
Dormancy is all about timing. If you go into dormancy very, very early in the season, you haven't had an adequate opportunity to make lots of progeny or young.
If you go dormant too late, you die.
And that's a bad thing as well.
So this is something Bradshaw and Holtzapfel call strong selection pressure.
Meaning there are rewards for getting the timing right, you get to live.
And negative consequences to getting the timing wrong. Now here is what's interesting about all this. The factors that determine what's too late and what's too early for the mosquito are shifting with climate change.
Okay.
What happens when you go into dormancy too late?
You die.
You die.
With climate change, winters are milder than they used to be. So the cutoff point separating the mosquitoes that die from the ones that live is actually arriving later in the year. Or another way to look at it, mosquito populations in the far north go into dormancy around a week later than they did 30 years ago.
It sounds like that there's some sort of optimal window in time and that window is shifting later in the year.
Well, it's thanks in part to that variation, right? By having a range of timing responses within a population, the pitcher plant mosquito always has a chunk of individuals that get the timing right.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And make it through the window to pass on their genes.
And because they have short generation times, the mosquito can evolve in a time period as short as 5 years, right?
Exactly. Though it's kind of a bittersweet thing for Bradshaw and Holtzapfel.
We feel the fact that Waiamaya is able to adapt and evolutionarily change in response to rapid climate change is a very positive thing. It makes us feel happy. At the same time, we are not so naive to think that we can take its success and say that that reflects what is going to happen to large mammals and to humans, for example.
You know, if you think about it, a mosquito can go through many generations in the time it takes a polar bear to learn its first baby steps.
Yikes. So that means many species aren't going to be able to bob and weave here. I mean, they're not going to be able to adapt, especially in the hardest hit areas of the globe. We've heard about the poles, but there's another red zone. Coming up after the break, the heat is on in Australia. You're listening to the DNA Files. We'll be back in a minute.
To listen to extended interviews from this program, go to our website, dnafiles.org. This is NPR.
Pakistan's opposition leader Benazir Bhutto was killed this morning in a suicide bomb and gun attack. AM 580 later today will bring you an NPR news special looking at Bhutto's legacy as the one-time prime minister of Pakistan and what her death means for the region. Neil Conan will be the host. The 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine will not be heard today. The latest on the situation in Pakistan this afternoon at 1 o'clock Central Time on AM 580, WILL, Urbana.
Welcome back to the DNA Files. I'm John Huckenberry here with reporter Adam Burke. Adam?
Hi again.
We're exploring climate change as an evolutionary phenomenon, a force that's rejiggering the planet on both a physical level and a genetic level. And we've sent our producer Adam out into the world. Out into the world. Did you hear that, Adam? To find out how global warming is pushing species around. Before the break, we heard how species are shifting around geographically, changing their seasonal timing, and adapting genetically in response to a warming world.
But if, on the other hand, you don't have that kind of wiggle room?
For example, if you happen to be a little colony of branching coral on Australia's Great Barrier Reef, about the size of a head of cauliflower.
And we're not saying that you are.
It's not like you can pack up the store and head south or north or wherever things might be better. You're stuck. You just sit there. Whoa, sounds like we're on a boat. What happened? Are we on a boat?
We are on a boat near the Lizard Island Research Station, which is at the northern end of the Great Barrier Reef.
Okay.
And a team of divers from James Cook University are getting ready to collect the kind of coral you were just talking about.
You mean the small reddish-brown, about the size of a head of cauliflower coral?
Yeah, that one. Passalopera damicornis. the kind marine biologist Morgan Pratchett studies.
It's one of the more important corals in terms of habitat for fish and other invertebrates which tend to live within the branches of corals. So we're going to go collect a heap of these corals and see what's inside them.
Inside of coral? What's inside of coral?
Well, he's looking for little crabs and shrimp and starfish and other critters that live in the nooks and crannies of the branches.
Uh-huh.
So soon they're swimming around 15 feet below the surface, prying loose colonies of Passeropora damicornis. Now that's just one of over 300 species of coral on the Great Barrier Reef. They come in all sizes, shapes, and colors.
Most typically that ranges from brown to green to blue, and really quite dark colors.
Some look like big thickets of branching antlers. Others are round and solid, textured like brains. But the structure you see is not the coral animal. It's a calcified skeleton of sorts.
It's like the house of the animal, I guess, right?
More like a high-rise building. And the tiny coral animal is attached to the calcified structure.
Mm-hmm.
And living inside the cell tissue of this coral animal are microscopic single-celled plant species called, brace yourself for this, John, zooxanthellae.
Zooxanthellae? Hey, how do you like me now? That is a mouthful, though.
Yeah, and it's this symbiosis that allows corals to grow all these fancy structures. The photosynthetic plant harnesses energy from the sun and passes on nutrients to the coral animal, and the coral animal gives nutrients to the plant.
So this animal and plant working together build all these fabulous apartment buildings. Is it a happy relationship?
It's a happy relationship most of the time, but it falls apart when times get tough. Pollution, changes in ocean salinity, temperature extremes.
Any number of these factors could cause a coral to become physiologically stressed, and as a consequence, it'll undergo bleaching. And bleaching is a process where the symbiotic algae, the zooxanthellae, essentially evicted from the coral host.
This bleaching business sounds serious. I mean, can the coral roommates get back together?
Well, that depends on how extreme the stress factors are. Historically, bleaching events were small and local. But over the last few decades, warmer ocean temperatures have brought regional-scale bleaching. In 1998, it's estimated that 12 to 15% of the world's corals died. So, with global temperatures going up, Morgan Pratchett is trying to understand the relationship between reef biodiversity and the presence of living coral.
We don't know all the myriad of organisms which live on a reef, but if we just think about coral reef fish, at least 70% of those species decline in abundance after a bleaching event.
And don't forget, it's the fish that bring in all those snorkeling tourists.
Right.
Worth about $5 billion Australian dollars a year.
Whoa, that's how the food chain works, I guess. It's not just a few scientists who are wringing their hands over climate change and coral reefs, eh?
Nope.
So it seems that the key question here is, can coral actually adapt to warmer oceans, even though it's stuck right where it is?
Well, some scientists say no.
Oh.
And the reason is that symbiosis we were talking about earlier.
You mean the zooxanthellae business with the little coral animal you were talking about?
Yeah, it's a tricky evolutionary relationship. I mean, let's say one of these symbiotic zooxanthellae is floating around in the ocean.
Okay.
Just a little cell. And then that little cell bumps into the particular species of coral host that it likes to live with.
Okay.
That symbiont has to get inside a cell of the coral animal, which is not the easiest thing to do.
Cells spend a lot of energy trying to prevent things from invading them because they're a little lump of energy and they're trying to keep it for themselves, right?
Meet Ove Hogelberg, a marine biologist at the University of Queensland.
There are these immune systems and there's ways of destroying invading pathogens and bacteria and so on. And then suddenly it's come inside and live inside my cell. You know, I'm not going to fear you, I'm going to live with you. And, of course, that's a very bizarre situation when you think about it.
I'll say, but they are coral, after all. And how do these coral know if you're a friendly cell or an enemy cell?
What we do know is that there are some molecules on the surface of the right type of zooxanthellae which are being recognized by systems on the coral side. And this is acting essentially like a set of keys. You get the key to the first room if you get into the cell. A broad range of cells might actually get taken in. But what happens next is, if they're the wrong type, then they get attacked by little parts of the host cell called lysosomes, and they're eliminated that way. So if you have the first set of keys, you get into that first room. If you have the second set of keys, you avoid digestion. Then the next trick is, of course, you've now got to integrate into the physiology of the host. So this is like the third set of keys. And this is where you have the ability to take up nutrients from the host and to pump out sugars and make sure that you start to grow in the tissues.
So it's pretty complex and delicate on the molecular level. And we're talking about two species that have both evolved together. And Hogelberg believes that coevolution took a long time.
I think the problem with this is it's not a single character. It's a whole set of genes which are involved in symbiosis, which have to be concerted in their evolution. You know, maybe hundreds of genes have to slowly co-evolve with the host to get to a point where they've got this sophisticated and intimate relationship between the two cells.
Now, that's not saying corals can't evolve to cope with increased temperatures. In fact, there's evidence that they can and have. The Great Barrier Reef is 1,400 miles long. Temperatures range from one end to the other. And you can find the same coral symbiont combination living in different locations with different temperature tolerances. So Terry Hughes, who runs the ARC Center for Marine Excellence in Townsville, Queensland, says it's premature to say whether corals will adapt or not.
Clearly, corals are locally adapted to the temperature regime that they're currently found at. We don't know how long that local adaptation took. It might have taken millennia. So the million-dollar question is, can corals adapt to rapidly rising temperatures? And we don't know the answer to that.
They do know these mass bleaching events can be somewhat selective. Some species are surviving better than others.
We're already seeing a shift in the composition of species in favor of species that are more resistant to bleaching.
So in the short run anyway, Hughes believes we'll continue to have what he calls vibrant coral reefs if we can slow the rate of climate change.
I don't want to overstate the optimism. I think coral reefs are going to be degraded, but I don't think we're going to see them destroyed in 30 years. We're going to see a shift in species composition. But if we can limit the temperature rise to 2 or 3 degrees...
That's 4 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit.
And if we take strong action now, then I think we've got considerable optimism in terms of the future of coral reefs.
So Terry Hughes sounds hopeful here. And I have to say, it's kind of a relief to hear that reefs won't be destroyed in the short run.
On the raw face of it, yes, that's correct.
There's Ove Hogelberg again.
Yeah, and he would tell you the changes that Terry Hughes is talking about aren't just cosmetic.
I think it's a little misleading to say that they're going to be anything like a coral reef as we know it today, because corals, I think, will be quite rare organisms. They've got huge ranges, they can reproduce asexually, so there's no problem about corals in the short term as far as extinction. But in terms of their dominance of ecosystems like the Great Barrier Reef, I think they will be rare members of the community.
When it comes to extinction, it's difficult to know exactly which species are next. But that doesn't stop scientists from trying to understand how rare species will fare with this climate change business. I mean, I'd want to know if I was next.
Me too.
So just the Great Barrier Reef along the northeast edge of Australia, there are scientists who are studying species at risk. And you went out with them into the woods, Adam, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me if I have this right. These are a chain of mountains in Australia known as the wet tropics.
That's right. That's right.
High altitude, right? Cool, misty rainforests.
It's exactly right. The wet tropics are some of the last shreds of an ecosystem that once blanketed Australia. And Steve Williams studies the plants and animals that live only in the wet tropics. In other words, found nowhere else in the world. He's an ecologist based at James Cook University in Townsville, Queensland. But more often than not, you can find them out in the rainforest with a research team documenting biodiversity.
There's another possum way up in the canopy.
Oh, yeah.
Another limeroid.
So it's the middle of the night, and we're out with flashlights counting the marsupial possums that we can spot in the tree canopy. These animals are about the size of a cat. They're hundreds of feet up, but you can actually identify them by the color and shape of their eye shine, or at least Steve Williams can. We're also on the lookout for other nocturnal animals, owls, bats, a rare species of kangaroo that lives in trees.
Oh, man, dude, you saw kangaroos that live in trees? That's
We didn't see any.
Oh.
But one of the students caught a lizard called a leaf-tailed gecko, and we all gathered around. A foot long, mottled green and tan coloring, bulging yellow eyes.
Cool.
Yeah, well, these things rely on camouflage. You can see by the pattern they look like the lichen on tree bark. And their tail is leaf-shaped, which is what gives them their name, leaf-tail geckos. And even their eyes have camouflage pattern on them. Give them a little squeak. Hey, cutie.
Wow, they are really beautiful.
They are. They're fantastic. One of my favorite animals.
With a tail shaped like a leaf and yellow camouflaged eyes.
It looks like a creature from another planet.
Oh, man.
The belly's just like soft as silk, isn't it? Yeah. You feel the belly.
Can I feel the belly too?
Oh. In the last few million years, climate has fluctuated wildly in the wet tropics. For example, the last ice age, 18,000 years ago, caused the region to dry out considerably, leaving just tiny islands of cool, misty rainforest on a few mountaintops.
As the rainforest contracts, each one of those mountaintops becomes more and more isolated and smaller area. Sometimes if it gets too small or the rainforest completely disappears, the populations in that area would have gone extinct. And as the rainforest has expanded again over the last 5,000 years, species have been able to recolonize those mountains.
So climate has crunched the forest down to these tiny isolated pockets, and then they've expanded out again and crunched down again and expanded out again.
And the tiny isolated pockets that remained became kind of these life rafts for many species of vertebrates. That's where they hunkered down and rode out the dry times. Creatures like the lemuroid ringtail possum.
And I'm almost afraid to ask, the tree kangaroo?
Yep, and the tree kangaroo, and birds and frogs, and our friend the leaf-tailed gecko.
Your friend.
My friend. All of these different critters survived in tiny patches of forest that were left on mountaintops.
So whatever happened to your little leaf-tailed gecko pal? I mean, what did the scientists do with it?
Well, they weigh it, measure it, record the coordinates where it was found, and they take a DNA sample.
That's interesting. I don't know how interesting for the gecko, but it's interesting.
It is really interesting. Part of this story of past climate change can be found in the genes of these animals.
Really?
Yeah, which is why Steve Williams is working with a population geneticist named Craig Moritz at the University of California, Berkeley, to decode this story of past isolation.
Take a population down to a very small size. It loses a lot of its genetic variation. And that loss of genetic variation takes a long time to recover. You have to get it back by mutation. And that takes tens of thousands of years to do. So there's a record of history sitting in the DNA that we can use to try and estimate what was the population size like through time from the pattern of variation.
So, for example, if a population of leaf-tailed geckos were confined to a mountaintop thousands of years ago, that population is going to have a recognizable genetic signature.
Just because of a mountain? Why?
Well, remember, Craig Moritz said, take a population down to a very small size, and it's going to lose a lot of its genetic variation. Okay, here, let's think about it this way. See this bag of candy?
This bag of candy right here?
That bag of candy.
Oh.
There are 13 different colors of jelly beans inside.
You've already inspected this?
I have already inspected it. Now reach in, grab a small handful, and put them in that bowl.
All right.
Just a small handful, John.
There's some for you. Don't worry.
Okay, so what colors do you have?
All right, I've got some dark blues, two yellows, a brown one, some red ones.
So just four of the 13 colors.
Yep, that's all I got.
So it's not really a surprise, right, that there's going to be less variety in the bowl than there is in the whole bag? I mean, odds are really low that you're going to have all the colors, right?
Right, so 13 colors in the bag, only four in my little bowl here.
The same thing happens with leaf-tailed geckos when their habitat crunches down to a little island on a mountaintop.
Right.
That bag represents the diversity before the crunch. The candy in your hand represents the genetic diversity of geckos remaining on a particular mountaintop after the crunch.
Okay.
Okay, so now reach in the bag and get another handful and tell me the colors.
All right. All right, we've got one brown, some yellows, some orange ones, and some green ones.
So that represents the genetic diversity of geckos on another mountaintop.
Different combinations of colors.
And each combination represents a different genetic signature.
Which allows our geneticist Moritz to tell descendants of one population from another.
Exactamundo. So they start with some genetic data collected from leaf-tailed geckos throughout the wet tropics.
So we look at the leaf-tailed geckos. We see two genetic groups. Within each population, the level of variation is exceptionally low, which suggests they contracted back to a very small population.
And because they've mapped where each genetic gecko sample came from, they know something about where these creatures survived during the rough times.
There are different numbers of genetic clusters, if you like, within each species. So the leaf-tailed gecko had just two, one north, one south, very, very clear picture. In others, there could be five or six or seven different genetic groups, which implies that they survived the glacial periods in multiple places.
There are actually a whole range of genetic signatures that tell Moritz where species hunkered down, where they went locally extinct, and how long it took them to spread back out again.
It's like DNA is a map. I mean, Steve Williams is out there running around in the woods, catching lizards and frogs and taking tiny tissue samples, which he sends to Craig Moritz.
And Craig Moritz uses the genetic signatures to reconstruct a story of how that map has changed over time for the gecko and many other species in the wet tropics.
It's like trying to read molecular tea leaves. You know, whoa, you know, what's in the bottom of the cup and what did that mean about the past? You need to draw multiple lines of evidence. And it's when you put all the different lines of evidence together, we can build up a fairly consistent picture of what happened.
Williams and Moritz are also using their information to estimate how these species are going to cope with rising temperatures now, based on what happened in the past.
How much warming is predicted here?
Between 3 and 10 degrees Fahrenheit.
The Fahrenheit thing again. And what do they say will happen to the wet tropic species?
Similar to what happened in the past. As temperatures increase, these species will retreat up to the highest reaches of the mountains until there's nothing above but blue sky.
I think the consensus at the moment is that this is a type of climate that these faunas simply haven't experienced in the last few million years. And these species which formerly evolved in much cooler, wetter climates are going to get hammered. So I desperately hope these models are wrong, and we're doing everything we can to disprove them.
Coming up, a species that is changing the climate. This is The Heat is On, Evolution in Action. We'll be back in a minute.
To learn more about the science mentioned in this program, go to our website, dnafiles.org. This is NPR.
Pakistan's opposition leader, Benazir Bhutto, was killed this morning in a suicide bomb and gun attack. AM 580 later today will bring you an NPR news special looking at Bhutto's legacy as the one-time prime minister of Pakistan and what her death means for the region. Neil Conan will be the host. The 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine will not be heard today. The latest on the situation in Pakistan this afternoon at 1 o'clock Central Time on AM 580, WILL, Urbana.
This is the DNA Files. I'm John Hockenberry, and Adam Burke is with me. Adam?
Hi, John.
So we've been talking today about how a little bit of climate warming over the past century, just 1.2 degrees on average, has already shaken up the biological world and is pushing species toward extinction. But what we tend to forget in all this is how ordinary extinctions are. Earth, you see, is not a stable place. Never has been. You've got continents moving around, you've got changes in temperature, changes in ocean chemistry, you've got volcanoes, even asteroids hitting the Earth.
At the end of the Permian era, 241 million years ago, there was a massive extinction.
That's evolutionary biologist Steve Jones of the University College London.
Over 90% of all creatures disappeared. Whole groups of animals like the trilobites, one of the most abundant of all, just went. Fortunately, a few things were left. And evolution went back almost to the beginning of the chess game and started again.
Lucky for us.
That's right. And you might see this as a story of resilience. But it also reminds us that even the most robust life on Earth could be a hair's breadth away from the whirling blades of extinction, at least if you consider evolutionary time.
I often think of natural selection as a factory. a factory for making almost impossible things. You're an almost impossible thing. I am. Every bird is. Every plant is. Every bacterium is. You and I and all those other creatures stand at the summit of an enormous mountain of extinct life, creatures which did not survive to pass on their genes.
It's amazing. Jones is describing an entire parallel universe of extinct life. Our current warming trend here on Earth could add another heap of species to that collection of extinct organisms. Kind of makes me wonder, what kind of a world are we headed for here?
Evolution in some ways is the triumph of the weeds, and the weeds are already taking over. Climate change is going to make it worse.
I don't suppose Jones is talking about dandelions or crabgrass.
Not really, but sort of. I mean, he is talking about all the species that can live in a wide range of habitats. You know, the cockroaches, the raccoons, the coyotes.
And the weediest species of all, of course, is Homo sapiens, in the sense that we're the species that's come and ruined everybody else's habitat and trampled all over it through our own delectation, rather than staying rare, specialized, and rather beautiful within a valley in East Africa.
Get used to it, folks. Homo sapiens, the ultimate weed. We live on almost every continent and in almost every climate on Earth. Why didn't we remain rare, specialized, and beautiful in a valley in East Africa?
I've got a theory to share.
Well, aren't you just the little theory meister here?
It's a good one.
Okay, let's hear it.
Okay, good. So anthropologists have long theorized that climate change played a role in making humans the wily generalists that we are.
Oh, you wily generalist, you. But I've heard that theory. 5 million years ago, human ancestors were living in dense forests. And then when East Africa transitioned into an open grassland environment all of a sudden, our ancestors had to come up with a very serious plan B.
Yeah, and anthropologist Rick Potts of the Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. says this was a prevailing theory for a long time.
We kind of all thought that we knew what the setting was, that basically Africa dried out. And that was the cauldron in which human evolution took place. It bubbled along, and out came new adaptations to the challenges of the open grasslands.
That sounds like the standard evolutionary story.
Well, it is. The environment changes, and human ancestors evolve to cope with the new environment, giving rise to the many things we prize in ourselves.
Like tool use, like walking upright, social cooperation, hunting, meat eating.
And you could basically unfurl all the different qualities that we are so proud of in terms of human uniqueness just by getting early humans into one environment.
Now, as I'm listening, I assume there's a flaw in this theory, right?
Well, the problem with that is that there's no longer any evidence for it.
Now, East Africa is drier than it was 5 million years ago. But when you consider multiple sources of climate data, things like ancient pollen samples, lake beds, sediment cores from the Indian Ocean,
none of that indicates that the savanna was contemporaneous with the earliest evidence of fossil humans. And so the question is, well, what is the environment?
It turns out it wasn't any one environment at all. Rick Potts turned to paleoclimate modelers like Peter Domenical of Columbia University, and Domenical says East Africa saw dramatic climate swings between wet and dry over the last 5 million years. Or as he puts it, there were greener times and browner times.
Greener times with more vegetation, browner times with less vegetation.
So in some periods, rainfall increased and forests expanded. In others, rain was more scarce and things dried out.
Right. But remember, this swinging back and forth is happening over periods of tens of thousands of years. And Domenical's data lets him watch these fluctuations like a movie.
If you were to play this movie, you would see this pulsing of greener times and browner times going back and forth. But then as we move toward the present, you notice that the range of variations increases as well.
In other words, there were times, stretches of a few 100,000 years, where the swings between wet and dry became more dramatic.
So greater contrast between the wet-wet and the dry-dry during these periods.
Yeah, and Rick Potts began to believe that the increase in climate variability was an important piece of the human evolution story.
It dawned on me that we really didn't have any idea about what that meant. We always treated it as just noise in the signal. The signal represented the constant qualities of environments, the stable qualities. But to my mind, the variability might itself represent a very important signal of uncertainty and unpredictability that might help us understand the emergence of new adaptations, new traits.
This is something Potts calls variability selection, and the idea is that environmental instability over long periods of time will favor organisms that can cope with a range of environments.
What ultimately will survive that are those genes and those strategies of behavior that allow versatility, allow a versatile or adaptable response to when things do change.
What's interesting is that the fossil record of human ancestry seems to bear this idea out. For example, take the well-known fossil, Lucy.
Oh, yeah, I know her. Female, about 3.2 million years old, discovered in Ethiopia in the mid-1970s, likes to date anthropologists.
That's the one. Lucy is the most famous fossil member of a species called Australopithecus afarensis. Lasted in Africa for 1 million years in a region that fluctuated dramatically between wet and dry.
What was amazing is that Lucy's lineage was found in all of the layers through all of these different environmental changes. And Lucy was an amazingly adaptable early human, even without a large brain and stone tools. Lucy's lineage, Australopithecus afarensis, became extinct sometime around 2.9, 2.8 million years ago. And that's a time when the amount of environmental fluctuation in Africa increased even more than it was during Lucy's time.
Around the same time, two new hominids emerge, including the earliest appearance of our own genus, Homo, the first hominid with a slightly larger brain.
And what's interesting is that what comes out of Lucy's extinction is the emergence of two new branches in the human family tree that are more adaptable than Lucy was.
So Potts argues environmental instability rewarded those that could branch out and diversify. And he lumps cultural innovations in there, too. This same period, 2.8 to 2.5 million years ago, marks the earliest evidence of eating meat and the earliest evidence of stone tools, which Potts says was like getting access to a whole new set of teeth.
All sorts of different foods open up to the possibility of being processed with these stone tools, with these teeth outside of your body.
Stone tools were an early indication that human ancestors were becoming more adaptable, not only by evolving new physical characteristics, but by tinkering with the environment and sharing their know-how with each other.
So better brains meant more elaborate cooperation, snazzier tools, we get language, agriculture. All these are adaptive responses to a volatile environment.
That's what Potts argues.
We are tinkerers. We change and we like to change everything. And what we face right now is an experiment in Earth's climate that has never really been tried. We are now a new factor on the volatile planet. It's not that the planet is inherently stable. We know that that's not the case. The problem is that we are now pulling on some of the same strings that in the past led to climate change and led to extinctions.
Okay, that's a problem, but to deal with it, we've got our plasticity and our adaptability as a species, an evolutionary product of a volatile world, right? I can feel good, but I have a feeling there are people who disagree with Potts, right?
Sure, there are other theories on what drove human evolution, and then some anthropologists say it's an interesting idea with no conclusive data.
But whatever disagreement there might be about the mechanisms that drove human evolution, I mean, few can argue about the net result. We're doing pretty well here.
It's hard to argue with the reality of 6.7 billion Homo sapiens.
That's right. We talked with a guy who spent his life thinking about human population numbers, Paul Ehrlich of Stanford University. He says the way we have literally infested the planet is a kind of evolutionary success.
One can argue about whether certain bacteria or so on are dominant over us, but there's no question that as animals go, we're the top dog on the planet.
And it's those very same human top dog qualities forged over the last 5 million years that Ehrlich says explains why we have become the life of the party here on Earth.
So we have a relatively small but very effective set of genetic information which produces, among other things, this marvelous brain and the capacity to manipulate gigantic amounts of cultural information.
We pass along our genes, and in a similar way, we pass along our culture. Ehrlich argues that culture is what gives Homo sapiens the power to respond to environments in very rapid and sophisticated ways. In early human societies, you didn't need to invent stone tools from scratch every generation. You could learn how to make them from your pals. In modern societies, we screw in a light bulb and flip the switch without ever needing to know how to make one. We evolved to do this, and we do it very, very well.
human beings have become dominant by manipulating their environments. In other words, rather than just reacting to whatever the environment does, we change environments. And that's what we're still doing. We are now changing the environment of essentially every organism on the face of the planet.
And now we've tilted the climate systems, too. It's an unintended byproduct of the human way of life. But the reality of climate change challenges Homo sapiens to change the way we live. And the stakes are high. Rising sea levels, disrupted food supplies, rising temperatures that could throw Earth's systems into ecological chaos.
So it's basically a problem in cultural evolution. How do you transform what we know scientifically and what we know we should be doing into actual social action? And there's lots and lots of things we could be doing this very day. So the issue is, why don't we use the tools we've evolved?
Yeah, John. Why don't we?
You're asking me?
I'm asking you.
You're asking me?
I'm still asking you.
Well, I was thinking of this story Rob Boyd tells. He's an anthropologist from UCLA.
And that would be the story of...
You know the story. You know the story. Eric the Red.
Oh, Eric the Red.
Eric the Red settled in Greenland from Iceland right around 1000 AD, and there was a fairly thriving community of Norse settlers on the southwest coast of Greenland. Think of these people living on, you know, beautiful grassy valleys on the edge of fjords and stone houses and living and marrying and drinking and doing all the things that people did.
So there they were,
minding their own Nordic business,
growing hay in summer and storing enough to last the winter months. And it lasted that way in Greenland for a few hundred years. And then the Little Ice Age happened.
When it got a little colder, it shifted the balance so that the system they had, the Norse economic system, stopped working.
What does he mean it stopped working, you might ask?
There were occasional visits from trading ships from Iceland, and the last one came and everyone was dead.
So, really stopped working.
Meanwhile, living up the coast, there were Inuit hunter-gatherers who also had to brave the Little Ice Age, but they survived in different ways.
Think kayaks, harpoons, a delicious seal diet.
And the interesting thing is there was lots of contact between the Norse and the Inuit. And so even though their neighbors were a success, the Norse never copied this way of life from their neighbors and stuck to their guns and in the end went out of business.
Score one for the Inuit. So the question, of course, is why? Why did these Norse settlers starve to death when the keys to survival were right in front of their highly evolved adaptive faces?
You know what I would have done?
What?
I would have put down my horned Viking hat and started taking harpoon lessons from my Inuit buddies.
Some Viking you are. I mean, you're a sensitive international guy, Adam. Of course you would have done that. And maybe there were some Nordic folks who traded their myths for mukluks, but not enough did. Most didn't. No one knows why for sure, but Rob Boyd thinks that culture had something to do with it.
So even though the Inuit system seemed to be better, you could see a Viking guy thinking, well, my neighbors will think it's ridiculous if I stop farming and start paddling around in a kayak. That's not what we do. That's what those other people do. And so I think that it's completely understandable how this happened. But it does illustrate that despite the fact that we're great adapters, sometimes we don't adapt well enough.
So culture is kind of our mixed blessing. It's brought humankind a long, long way. But sometimes culture also prevents us from recognizing the path to survival, even if it's right there in front of us.
We have the capability of adapting that's unprecedented, I think, and that comes from the fact that we have these cultural tools which let us adapt non-genetically on really rapid timescales. But whether we'll channel those in our collective interests, that's the hard question.
Hard question? Hard question. That is the only question. There is no other question than this.
Okay, so where does that leave us?
Well, it seems like it leaves us facing the same mind-boggling global problem we started with, Adam. I mean, climate change is going to hit us, right?
Right. I mean, it's already hitting us.
The question is, what human changes is that going to bring?
Right now, we're dealing with an Earth that's warming because of human activities. That's just the fact, Jack.
The climate space in which species now exist is gone if we have business as usual.
Humans are just one species of perhaps 10 million on the planet.
Who among us cannot give up one or two luxuries?
If all we could do is slow the process of climate change, we would provide greater opportunities for plant and animal communities to adapt.
We're either as a culture, and we're a global culture in this sense with this problem, we're either going to solve it as a global culture or we're not going to solve it as Homo sapiens.
Ehrlich said it. We are an evolutionary experiment living on the edge.
An almost impossible thing.
I love that. A hominid with a big, adaptable brain.
Capable of unlocking nature's secrets and solving the puzzles inside.
And whether we like it or not, we are the authors of the latest chapter in the human evolutionary story. What do you out there think should be written? Here with Adam Burke, I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening to the DNA Files.
To find out more about climate change, evolution, and genetics, visit our website at dnafiles.org, where you can download a podcast of this program. This series, The DNA Files, was produced by Sound Vision Productions, with funding by the National Science Foundation, U.S. Department of Energy, National Institutes of Health, and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. This program, The Heat is On, Climate Change and Genetics, was produced by Adam Burke. The DNA Files is Managing Editor Loretta Williams, Editor Deborah George, Science Content Editor Sally Lehrman, Research Director is Addie Gevins. Production support by Noah Miller, Julie Kane, and Raynell Reno. Office support provided by Steve Nunez and Beverly Fitzgerald. Our web director is Jenna Allison. Technical engineer and music director is Robin Wise. Our host is John Hockenberry. Our theme music was composed and performed by Steve White. Additional music by Adam Burke, Conrad Pretzel, and Robert Powell. Marketing of the DNA Files is by Chart Media. Legal services by Cooper, White & Cooper and Spencer Weisbroth. Special thanks to Murray Street Productions. Send your responses and letters to feedback@dnafiles.org. For CDs and transcripts, call 888-303-0022. That's 888-303-0022. The executive producer is Barry Scott. This has been a Sound Vision production, distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.
Thanks to your generosity, 2007 has been another year filled with great radio and television programs on WILL. And with your help, we'll continue that tradition in 2008. Hi, I'm Station Manager Jay Pierce. As the year ends, please make a tax-deductible gift to WILL and help us reach our December 31st goal of $920,000. Call 217-244-9455 or make a gift online at willpledge.org. Thank you.
It's about a minute and a half before 12 noon here at WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. I'm Tom Rogers. Jason Croft is our technical director. We have some schedule changes this afternoon because of current events today. Coming up at 12 noon, we will go to the BBC for a full hour of their program, World Have Your Say. The world talking today about the assassination of former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. We'll have that program at 12 o'clock. At 12:30, we'll have a brief look at AM 580 News. You'll get an update on the gasoline spill from last night and the cleanup going on today on Champaign's west side. Also, a small train derailment near Monticello, which took out power to some residences. And we'll have details on those stories and more coming up at 12:30. At 1 o'clock, Neil Conan hosts an NPR News special. We'll get an American point of view on the Bhutto assassination and what that means for the future of Pakistan and the world. The NPR News special comes your way at 1 o'clock Central Time. And then at 2 o'clock, as a schedule before, America Abroad. The closing market report will not be heard today. So that's coming up on AM 580 over the next 3 hours. Our